Welcome to Between the Lines. Listening to literature online. This is show number 90. It's time to be real. Copies, facsimiles, trying to figure out what's real food, what's genetically modified, trying to figure out what people are real, getting real, being real. That's the topic. Short bit from Lawrence Ferlinghetti poem, touch on some Zen, and just kind of riff on the topic. This is your host, Monk. Thanks for listening. This is another show that seems to be the result of a failed attempt at writing. Last show I tried to write an essay about food. It turned into, I guess I'm going to call these verbal essays now. This started out as a poem. The poem didn't really go anywhere, so figured to talk about it. I got this phrase like the era of post-cool. This is the era of post-cool. Cool has been done. Trying to be this, trying to be that. It's time to be real. But that didn't really go anywhere. So figured it would be easier to just talk about it, try to give some examples, and it's one of those topics where there's not really a definitive answer. Just kind of throwing out ideas a bit. I have some sense of personal view on it, but the topic is about real. The thing about cool was just thinking about cool. Was that a poetry reading? And, you know, it's like sometimes people, the way they dress up or the looks they have, and you know, I want to make a point is I'm not coming from a judgmental way. You know, I'm open to all kinds of ways that people look and expect that, especially from an artist community. But it was just this subtle feeling of the difference between trying to be cool and just being real with each other. Sometimes the arts, I find that they become the the communication links with people, and people forget to connect personally a little bit more. So that's maybe a flavor of what I'm driving at. But anyway, the whole thing about the topic of real and what is real and how do we be real, that's sort of that unanswered question here. I think, though, that in general, cultural, consumer-wise, image-wise, there are these outer forms, and that people, we see it a lot nowadays, people wearing peace t-shirts and certain jewelry and a certain look that we associate with a type of person. It's almost become like a casual uniform, say, you know, maybe not like a monk's robe or somebody like that, but it's sort of like we see these stereotypical, you know, sort of uniforms. They're casual, they're by choice because people choose, but there's a flavor of commerciality in them. And then the question arises to me is it real? You know, here are these people wearing these peace t-shirts, and of course it's nice, there's some statement about peace, but are they peaceful? What are they, really peaceful people? It just raises the question to me about the outer form and the inner reality. And so I guess I'm just kind of in a phase of looking at some of these outer forms and wondering, you know, is it real? Is what's going on real? And wanting to connect more with the real. Interesting. A lot of the names of the indigenous peoples, Native American tribes, nations, a lot of them translate to the people or the real people. I'm not sure how to describe it, but just having hung out with a bunch of Native American or Native peoples over the years, it's hard to describe, but I know what it means. They're just being real. They're not the ones I've met, they're not putting on airs, they're not trying to be this or that. It's just, now it's not just Native peoples, I've met plenty of other peoples who are just being real. How to define that, I'm not sure. One example that came to mind is from Lawrence Ferlinghetti's fabulous epic poem part one, America's One. Now, a little spoiler alert, if you're planning to read the book soon and might not want to listen, but probably won't give it away, but I just found this bit to be sort of like the thesis. It's what I came away from the poem, which is something like 80-90 pages. It's what I came away from it with as, you know, the real lesson and thesis, or one of them. So it's about a page and a half. I'm going to read it and then say some stuff. The subjective, trying hard to take back the world from the objective guerrillas of the world. In 200 years of freedom, they had invented the permanent alienation of the subjective. Almost every truly creative being alienated and expatriated in his own country. In Middle America or San Francisco, the short-haired hard heads who still ruled everything stood like menhirs, M-E-N-H-I-R-S, I think that's stones or statues, like stones, stood like menhirs over the dark land. The alienated generations lived out their expatriate visions here and everywhere. The old generations lived out the Bohemian myth in Greenwich villages, lived out the Hemingway myth as the sun also rose and set on the dome in Paris or with the bulls at Pamplona, lived out the Henry Miller myth in the tropics of Paris and the great Greek dream of the Colossus of Marussi and the tropic dream of Gauguin and the D.H. Lawrence myth in the plumed serpent in Mexico Lake Chapala and the Malcolm Lowry myth under the volcano at Cuernavaca. And then the saga of On the Road and Bob Dylan blowing in the wind, how many roads must a man walk down? How many Neil Cassidy's on lost railroad tracks? How many replicas of Woody Guthrie with cracked guitar? How many photocopies of long-haired Joan? How many Ginsberg facsimiles and carbon copy Keezys wandering the streets of America in old tennis shoes and backpacks or driving beat-up buses with destination signs reading Further? How many Buddhist Catholics, how many cantors chanting the great Paramitra Sutra on the Lower East Side, how many whole earth catalogs lost in outhouses in New Mexico communes, the lonely and isolate satyrs are everywhere. Horsemen and bikers charge over the landscape westward, their penises raised like lances. Americus, Maximus, or Minimus standing on the corner, etc., etc. And then he's got a huge capitals. Outmoded capitalism threatens humanity with multiple perils. Pathogenic industrial output. My notes on this, I'll read my notes after reading this. I wrote, he nails it. America trapped in its own plethora of mythoses, its psychological privileges, instead of finding oneself, connecting with the true, communal, and already existing native wisdoms, etc. Where's the real vision of now? So the way he describes the, you know, how many replicas of Woody Guthrie, how many facsimiles of these people that, you know, like Dylan, sure, they're great to emulate, but it just gave me that image of like these hip, cool people walking around, and yet, yeah, there's a layer of hip coolness, but yet there's this deeper layer of, you know, are they still sort of caught in this emulating somebody phase and just, you know, trying to be like somebody else phase. Nothing wrong with it, but it's like lacking. That's what I got. I'm not sure what Ferlinghetti means by it, but that's what I got out of it. It's like lacking some real sense of destiny, some real sense of, you know, one's own true connection with the spirit, with one's path. Remembering Carl Jung has in his individuation phases, there is a phase where one sort of, it's not hero worship, but it's like a mentor or a guide or a role model. One emulates the role model, and you know, there's great figures, somebody like a Gandhi or a, you know, Jesus, or you know, for artists it's various arts people, cultural icons, whomever, that we take on these people as a role model to emulate. And it is a normal part of the learning phase before one kind of discovers oneself and goes beyond that role model. So maybe it's this phase of where we're at or where evolution is. I don't know. Another angle on the what is real, I find in the Zen stories, and recently written a poem called The Gateless Gated Community. So I was reading some of these stories in Zen Flesh, Zen Bones. It's a 12th or 13th century collection by Mumon. This was transcribed by Nyojin Senzaki and Paul Reps. It's in the book Zen Flesh, Zen Bones. You can find it online. And one of the things I like about these stories is they make my mind or my awareness just go to a different place. And that to me is another layer of getting past the, you know, it gets to what's real. Like here's a summary of one. Has a dog Buddha nature? This is the most serious question of all. If you say yes or no, you lose your own Buddha nature. So there again, I'm not sure the answer quotes there, but if you say yes or no, that you can't say yes or no. So that gets my mind going in a different direction. Okay, I can't say yes or no. So what am I going to say? Am I going to say maybe? Am I going to say am I not going to say anything? And then I go deeper on that, and it's kind of like, forget about whether you're saying yes or no. It's like tuning into some kind of experience. A lot of the Zen stories seem to point at that, a certain level of beingness, and they try to jog the mind into a different place. That is one of the purposes stated in the book and in Zen teachings, is jogging the mind past the duality and into a state of just clarity and awareness, which transcends those either ors, the yes or no. I mean, one can get up in the morning and have coffee, and then, well, Do you want to do this today? Yes or no? Or you can just start doing it, or you can just feel motivated to do it, or whether you want to or not, you just do it. So there's a kind of Zen, action, the putting the concept into action, that's my one of my examples of trying to explain this. If it's not yes or no, if it's not either or, then what is it? And one other idea along these lines, and sort of riffing off of that Ferlinghetti poem and how that brought up the thing about, are we copies or are we originals, or we are part of both, really. The other thing is how we label our paradigm experience. So when I hear Ferlinghetti talking, writing about America, and it's like people have this image or this label of what America is, and then they go about and try to live that. If your image is, Kerouacs on the road rebelling against society, then you're more likely to hop in a car and just freewheel it. So I look at that in a local way, living in a suburbia, and how do I view this? Do I live in suburbia? Do I feel like I'm, the more I have the consciousness of connecting with Mother Earth and the nature beings, even though I'm in suburbia, that shifts my focus. So I think that's a helpful thing I've found. I look at where to look at where one is at, and lay and sort of just explore the label or the paradigm that you put on it. Even if you're in a big city, you can find quiet places to have coffee, or take a nice little walk in the park, or you can minimize that sort of paradigm label that the city is a crazy bustling place. I mean, yeah, if you go into certain areas, you're gonna experience that, but then you can also remember that it used to be all mostly grass, and the native peoples lived there, and their spirits, their ancestors is under the concrete, and so you can tune into that energy. So there's a lot of choices that we have in dealing with both the reality that is existing, and then also how we can choose to experience that reality. So I think there's where we have a choice of how to be, quote, real or not, quote, to be real. But that, is flavored by, each person's what is real. So that's kind of like a mantra, I guess. I'm carrying that mantra around a bit more. It's like, what is real? And when I meet people, talk with people, who's being real, who's not being real? How do I respond to that? Some of the examples that come in is just sometimes hearing a song that is so beautiful and the music just touches me, and that is like, oh, that is real. That is like the nectar of the gods. It's like at the well, at the whatever it is, where you just soaking it up. It's like being out in the sunshine in May after the winter, and you're just soaking it up, and it's like, this is real. And a lot of days seem sort of like just going along, being okay with the being content with the nothing specialness. But then there's these reminders of what is sort of like the real juice, this sort of pith, this pith of life that Zen points to. And when that comes in, I don't know. I think sometimes it gets commercialized. It's like, to have the greatest, the bottle of wine that's been in the cellar for 100 years, and it just is amazing, and that so that becomes like this goal of what's real. But that is, that is more based on who can afford that bottle of wine. On a smaller level, is who can afford to listen to the CD maybe. But I think we can have these experiences, whether it's just outside, a simple bird landing right near you on your way to work, and you have that interaction, and that sort of like touches what's real. So yeah, I don't know what's real for you, but it's to me, it's the idea. There's certain things that come through, and they just sort of they shout real, and they become these sort of lodestars of what to aim for, strive for, without trying too hard, as the Asian philosophies remind us. So That's my verbal essay riff on real. And cool is still, I can still be cool, but I think it's time, especially to tie this in with what's going on a global level and all the craziness we read about in the news. It's like, okay, how much time do you want to spend trying to be cool when you could start being real and we start getting real with what's really going on? Thanks so much for listening. Take care. And we'll go out with an amazing rendition of the song Compared to What, sung by Al Jarreau. Try to catch the lyrics.